Okay, good morning, everyone. It's week two of the term, but it's a new series, as I explained last week. So it's week one of our new series, A Jewish Look at the Let Them Theory. So Let Them is a book, a recent book, or relatively recent, I'm not sure, by Mel Robbins, and it's become very popular. Every time I mention it to someone, they seem to know about it. There you are. So, as you know, I like to always be up to date with these things and then look at it through the Jewish lens. And especially, I was talking to someone lately who told me about it, and then she said, you have to do a Thursday morning series on it. So here we are. So actually, I haven't finished the book yet, but that doesn't matter. I'm working through it as we go along. It's a great formula. And it's a remarkable story, actually. It's a remarkable story of someone who was over 40 and turned their life around in a remarkable way. And she actually used two theories, which we'll talk about a bit today because it's important context. The first one is her first book, actually. I'm not sure if people have read it, called The 5-Second Rule. And then she went on to the Let Them Theory. So today we're more of a preparation, really, because I want to sort of talk about the first theory a little bit and also just the context of how we approach a book like this or a theory like this. So for me, the first lesson actually from the book was very inspiring, and that is, and I think that's a general concept, that it's never too late to change. Never too late to change and never too late to grow, right? In other words, we are never stuck. That's something we should always understand. And that's the power of the human being, that we never, no matter how old we are, no matter what our experience has been, we're always able to take the next step. We're always able to release ourselves from ourselves, to become unstuck and to grow and to change. I was reading a little bit of literature on this, and this is modern psychology has this very well researched, that there's no age limit to achieve success or to change and so on. And as long as someone has a pathway and a goal and purpose, right, it makes it possible to always, no matter where the stage of life is, to always keep going. I mean, there are many, many examples. Not that I'm recommending this franchise, obviously, but Colonel Howland Sanders, who started KFC, Kentucky Fried Chicken, which I'm not recommending, he did it for the non-Jews, right? He started the chain. He was 65. Yeah, he was 65. Do you know that?
Yeah,
he was 65. I've read that before, but he was 65. 9 years later, he had 600 franchises, and then later on, he sold his share for millions of dollars. And he was a pretty simple guy until then. He came with this idea, someone told him a recipe, or he found a recipe, or he tried it himself. I don't know exactly what he did. And that's it. He did it at 65 years old. So it's never too late. And there are many people. There's a lady I read about, Harriet Thompson. She was a cancer survivor, ran her first marathon when she was 76. Yeah, and in 91, she completed her 15th marathon, becoming the second oldest marathon runner in U.S. history. So it's a mindset thing, right? We have to adjust our mindset. It's about being creative. It's about really just focusing on that the human spirit, as long as we're around, we can grow. We can always achieve. We can always do things. In a more sort of spiritual context, there's a story, I think I've shared this story with you before, but there's a story of a great rabbi. He was called Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. He lived in the Lithuanian town of Salant. And he was the father of what we call today the Musar movement. There's a whole body of Jewish learning, which is called Musar, which is ethics and focused on growth and things like that. And one time at night, he was walking home late, quite late at night. And he saw a light in a window, and he saw there was a candle burning. It was the house of the tailor. And the tailor was doing work. He was fixing clothes. He was mending. He was doing it everywhere. So Rabbi Yisrael Salanter went over to the window. He knew they knew each other, and he said to him, I don't know what his name was, but he said to him, whatever it was, he says, how come you're working so late? So he told Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, obviously there was no electricity in those days. He said in Yiddish, he said, Kolzman de lichtel brenn kemen noch verrichten, which in English means, as long as the candle is burning, we can still fix. And Rabbi Sol Salanter was extremely inspired. He went away and he made that into a whole teaching, he says. Our soul is called the candle, right? Ner Hashem nishmat Adam, the Pasuk says. Our soul is like a candle. And therefore, as long as the candle is burning, no matter who we are, no matter what we are, we can still achieve. There's a Sydney story, actually, an interesting story of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Rabbi Feldman, who's still right here and lives in Sydney, he was once by the Rebbe many, many years ago. And his stepfather-in-law was a rabbi, he used to be a rabbi in Mizrahi, actually Rabbi Abramson. And then he moved away from that, and when he went into Yechidus, Rabbi Abramson had a very big connection with the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And when Rabbi Abramson went into when Rabbi Feldman went into the Lubavitcher Rebbe for a private audience, Rabbi Feldman asked, the Rebbe asked Rabbi Feldman about Rabbi Abramson. At that time, he moved on from Mizrahi already, and the Rebbe was worried that he wasn't active enough. And he told Rabbi Feldman, you have to see that he should be active, he should achieve, he should do things. And without thinking, Rabbi Feldman tells the story himself. He said to the Rebbe, you know, he's almost 70, he's slowing down. And as he said that, he thought how stupid it was, because at that time the Rebbe was turning 70. And the Rebbe smiled at him and said, Ich bin eich 70, I'm also 70, and I've got plans for another 10 years, and after that for another 10 years again. And the fascinating part was that some of the amazing accomplishments of the Rebbe of the world, the Lubavitch Worldwide Network and the Shluchim, and just the explosion of stuff that the Rebbe did was after he was 70. He only became the Rebbe when he was 48. He's 48, he started his career as the Rebbe, so to speak. And 70 didn't daunt him. In fact, he had a whole sicha, he had a whole talk at his 70th Fabrengen about people not slowing down when they get older, and so on and so forth. So it's a very inspiring thing about not, and I think it comes up in this book as well, the whole success of her theory and the whole success of what she did happened a bit later in life. It wasn't a young person sort of very ambitious and starting out and discovering something amazing. It was someone much, much later on. And of course, in Judaism, we have the famous Rabbi Akiva, right? Rabbi Akiva, who at 40 was illiterate. He was a small, simple shepherd who was illiterate at 40. Encouragement of his future wife, actually, who saw him and liked him, saw greatness in him. And the famous story about him watching a spring dripping one drop at a time on a stone and then eventually making a hole in that stone. Rabbi Akiva thought, well, even if my brain's like a stone, but if you keep at it, eventually you make a hole. And he married this girl, who's the daughter of a very rich man in Yerushalayim called Kalba Savua, who disinherited her because she married a simple shepherd. Fascinating story. And she sent him away to yeshiva. She said, I see the greatness in you. I'm willing to wait. And you go away to yeshiva and learn. When they were married already, right? And he came back, the famous Rabbi Akiva. And his father-in-law went out to meet him, didn't know it was his son-in-law, he didn't realize, he thought it's a famous rabbi from somewhere, and then discovered it's his son-in-law and asked him forgiveness and so on. But he became Rabbi Akiva, not just Rabbi Akiva, I mean, all the sages of the Talmud were giants, absolute giants. Rabbi Akiva was a giant amongst giants. He was the person who the entire oral Torah is attributed to him in a way. The whole Talmud, the Talmud says everything comes from his teachings, and it was just, we live and we learn from Rabbi Akiva's teachings till today, in the most significant way on all levels, on a philosophical level, on a halachic level, and so on and so forth. So it's just an amazing lesson. I just wanted to sort of share that at the beginning because I was thinking about that when I started the book where she talks about that until 41, at the age of 41, she was $800,000 in debt, unemployed, marriage on the rocks, and her husband had lost his business. So that was pretty great start to be at the age of 41, right? So let's just go through a little bit that concept of the 5-second rule. We'll talk about let them a little bit today, but then next we'll get into the let them theory much more. But I want to sort of break some stuff down because it's really important. So she writes that, as I said, at the age of 41, she was $800,000 in debt, unemployed, watching her husband's restaurant business crumble, and it just felt like that life had failed, right? So she did what a lot of people do, and that is avoidance. If you have a huge problem, you avoid. You avoid the bills. When you get up, instead of getting up, you hit the snooze button. Avoid pain with alcohol. Avoid responsibility by blaming everyone and everything. And avoid looking for another job by procrastinating. And as she says, when you're in that situation, the smallest of things is really hard, right? It's hard to get out of bed. It's hard to open the mail. It's hard to cook for your family. It's just hard to do anything, right? And she was just struggling and struggling and until it really became terrible, right? And she writes that in her head, she knew exactly what to do. She knew she had to get her kids ready for school. She had to go and walk. She had to reach out to friends for support, make a budget, all these things. She knew exactly what she had to do and couldn't do any of them, right? And then she said she'll never forget the morning that it changed. It was a very interesting way it happened to her. What changed was that she was getting up, or the alarm had gone, and she was going to press the snooze button again. And then something happened that changed her whole life. And she says it was really simple and almost stupid, but she suddenly remembered how she was watching a NASA launch of a rocket and how the countdown worked. And the countdown worked by counting 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, boom, right? So she said, why don't I just count backwards and launch myself out of bed, right? And at the time, of course, it seemed ridiculous, but she gave it a shot. She did that. She made a goal for herself. I'm going to count down to 1 from 5, specifically backwards, because then you can't go anywhere after 1, right? And you say, if you count to 10, that's not going to work, because if you count to 10, you're counting to 93, right? So, and then she stood it, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and got out of bed. And she thought, oh, that can work. And she started to do that with lots of things, and it was difficult. And she says, I still feel horrible. I don't have changed, but I just did what I needed to do, right? So she started doing it with alarm ring. She started doing it when the phone rang to find the job. She started doing when she had to open up mail to find the bills, and so on and so forth. And she says, the bottom line was, take action before hesitation kicks in, right? That was the count. That was the count. And she says, this is how it works. So counting backwards is effective, as we said. And once you start moving, it's way easy to keep going. And you do it one move at a time, right? Now, one of the real powers of this rule was not thinking about the problems. Not waiting till it feels good. Not waiting till you think you can do it. But just doing it. Right? The power of action. And she held this rule and she was getting really, really better. But she suffered from a lot of anxiety and also insecurity. And she was working for her. And she didn't share with anyone for 3 years. It was her own little thing, her own little mishigas, as they call it, right? That you keep there for 3 years. And then it says, it all changed one fateful day when an old roommate recommended me as the perfect person to give advice on career change, and she was invited to give a lecture. She gave a very famous TED lecture, which was one of her sort of inaugural address on the 5-second rule. She talks about the panic attacks that she had. She talks about the insecurity that she had, the tension, the anxiety that she had to get up there and froze and the whole business, but she ended up doing it, and then it became a very famous thing, and she started her first podcast, and from then everything really, really went stronger and stronger. She says waiting, this is really important, waiting is a problem, right? Now, I'm just emphasizing that because today there's a very, very big approach of people like waiting to do something till they're ready. You heard that expression? I'm not ready, right? A lot of people said, I'm not ready for that yet. That is the biggest hindrance to anything. You don't need to be ready. If you know in your head it's the right thing, do it. Just do it, right? And that's exactly what she did. And we'll sort of talk about this a bit later, how that works and what the power of that is. So she says, bottom line is, I was 49 when I self-published my first book, The 5-Second Rule, which I didn't even realize who wrote it. I actually bought this book about a year ago on the airport. Sometimes I go and I find another personal growth book and it looked good, so I bought it. I was reading it on the plane. It was really, really good. And then realized it was the Mel Robbins that wrote Let Them. Anyway, I was 54 when I launched the Mel Robbins podcast, one of the most popular and fast-growing podcasts in the world, which it is. Right? And then she makes another very, very important point. Besides the point of not waiting till you're ready and not overthinking your problem and not hesitating, she makes another important point, and that is, and that's the heading of the paragraph. It says, changing my life wasn't glamorous, it was grueling, right? And that's the bottom line. The bottom line is, change is hard. No one promised anyone that growing or changing or improving is easy, because it's not. And that's just the way it is. It's rewarding, but it's not easy. Just like anything is not easy in life, like fitness is not easy. I always give the analogy, if a person came from Mars and didn't understand the way the world works and saw people coming every day and volunteering to go on a treadmill and their face is like all fakvetched and they're obviously in pain, you think this is a crazy planet I just came to, right? It's like the craziest thing. These guys are crazy. Just don't go on if it's going to cause you so much pain. But everyone knows if you want to make progress, you're going to have to work for it. And you're going to have to schwitz. And you're going to have to have a fakvetched face for a little bit, right? Everyone understands fakvetched, right? So that was her first discovery. And then she says, as she's writing the book, she says, 2 years ago, I stumbled upon two words, let them. And we'll go into more detail next week of how that all came about. But that was very important for her because, and I'm just giving again, this is like the background to the whole discussion. She said, the 5-second rule changed my relationship with myself. The let them theory changed my relationship with other people. Right, and that's very important. Because the 5-second rule, she says, is about self-improvement. It'll help yourself get out of bed on the tough days, go to gym, do what you need to do, find purpose, find meaning, whatever the case is, right? But she says, but over the years, I've been wondering, why do I need constantly to force myself to move forward? Why am I so afraid of failing? Why am I so nervous about taking a risk? Why do I have a hard time asking for what I need? What exactly is in my way? And what comes out is that sometimes what's in your way is yourself, but sometimes what's in your way is other people. Your fear of other people, your fear of being disapproved by other people, by judged by other people, hurt by other people, offended by other people. And that's why that's when she launched into the second part of the theory, and that's the Let Them book, which is the theory of Let Them. Okay, which, as I said, we'll get into much more next week, understand how it actually works, about how not to define yourself by other people, and how not to control what you can't control, and how not to be afraid of what other people think of you. But I want to pause here and just for today and sort of break this down so far what we've talked about. So obviously in the Jewish perspective of change, it's not only, of course, going to the gym and eating healthy and making money and having a job, but it's much more than that. It's obviously growing in ways of meaning, in ways of purpose, and so on. Right? Not just career success, but it's also finding meaning in life. Because ultimately, the Viktor Frankl theory that we've talked about so many times is if you don't live a life of purpose, even if you're very successful, we know that a lot of people who are successful are not happy and don't have purpose in their life, and therefore they're very discontent, and if it doesn't really help them. So obviously, the growth that we're talking about or the success that people look for has to be linked with the concept of meaning and purpose as well. However, when we talk about the tools of growth, right? There are a couple of fundamentals that are across the spectrum. It doesn't matter what kind of growth you're doing. By the way, the topics in this book, the 5-second rule, and specifically in the Let Them, are not new modalities. That's the interesting thing about this. I think the greatness of the book is not that it's a new, as we call it, a new chiddush. It's not like a new thing, a new modality. It never existed. The theories exist, but it's the way it's packaged and the terminology and the way of applying it, which is so powerful, right? But there are fundamentals to growth. And the first fundamental is, like we said, you have to be committed to growth and you have to believe in your ability to grow. If you're 45 or whatever age you are and you think you're stuck, you have to believe that you're not limited. You have to believe that you can accomplish. You have to believe that there's still a purpose and a meaning in your life and there's a reason why you're here. We've talked about so many times the concept of the Modeh Ani prayer, right? Where we say right at the end of Modeh Ani prayer, Rabba Emunatecha, great is your faith. Which we've interpreted to mean that God says, we say to God, great is your faith in us. God woke us up today. It means he believes in us and he trusts us to do something. Doesn't matter how old we are. Doesn't matter how successful we are. Doesn't matter what we've done till now. The very fact that we are awake today means that we can grow and we can do something. And we can succeed with great meaning and purpose. Like the story of Yisrael Salanta. If the candle is still building, there's stuff to do. That's the general foundation. But then just going back to the 5-second rule is A second fundamental of growth is the power of doing, the power of action, the power of behavior. We've mentioned many times one of the great sages, the Jewish, early Jewish writers, writes, "Acharei ha-ma'asim nimshach ha-levavot," that after your actions, your hearts follow. Emotions come from action. Because it's very difficult to change your emotions. If you're not ready, if you're insecure about something, if you're afraid of something, if you have fear, if you have anxiety, if you're hurt, if you're offended, all those things are extremely difficult to change. Emotions are very difficult to change. And if you're going to wait till your emotions change, you're never going to do anything. Very simple. The 5-second rule tells us, don't wait for anything. Just do it. You know, in your mind, you don't feel that way, but in your mind, you know it's right. Just do it. The power of action. And when you keep just doing it, the emotion comes. Success breeds success. The heart follows actions. I've given this analogy to you many times. If you walk into a wedding, you're just not interested in dancing, you're not in the mood, just join the dance floor and you'll get in the mood. It's not like you'll just dance. For the first minute, you'll be doing it because you have to, because it's a nice thing to do. But actually, you'll get into it and you'll become happy. Maybe later you'll be upset again. But for now, you'll be happy, right? It'll definitely change you now. It's not going to change you fundamentally, but you'll be ready. You'll do it. The notion that I can't do something till I feel ready is such a mistake. It's a very popular notion, and it's a fundamental mistake. Because in Judaism particularly, we believe unbelievably in the power of action, right? I mean, in the religious part of Judaism, I mean, I say everything's, everything, Judaism covers everything, right? But even in the mitzvah part of it, it's the whole idea, is the mitzvah, just do it, right? How many times have I had people tell me, I don't want to do the mitzvah because I feel hypocritical? I don't know how much I believe in this. I don't know if it really means anything to me. If I do it, I'm not going to really have the right intention, the right kavanah. Who cares? Just do it. Now, I'm not saying that kavanah is not important. Of course, intention is important. Of course, feeling is important. We have this concept in Judaism called kavanah and mitzvah, the action of the mitzvah and the intention and the feeling that goes into it. And it's like a soul and body. And we do say that it's important. And we do say that if you do an action without feeling, it's a little bit like a body without a soul. That's true. It's not true. It is true. But it's not true that it should ever be an impediment to do, because the feeling will come as long as you keep doing it. There's something amazingly special about just doing something. It's a commitment. It's doing, and it breeds feeling. It breeds commitment. It breeds readiness. It breeds willingness. The power of an action. Right? And then we know that every small change we make, and it's also small changes. Like she says, it was 5 seconds at a time. It's not 5 seconds to get out of bed and to have an amazing day. No, it's 5 seconds just to get out of bed. That's it. You break it down. It's like with everything in life. You just break it down. I'm going to do 5 seconds. I'm going to... I once, many, many years ago, I watched a video about time management, and he was dealing with procrastination, right? And a lot of people suffer from procrastination, and it's a very simple thing. You just have a task in front of you that's overwhelming, right? So he talked about the salami method. You know the salami method? Salami method means that you don't eat the whole salami, you cut it into slices, right? Just say, I've got this like 150 files I've got to order, I've got to organize, right? Just say, I'm going to do 2 and get it done. And then you have a feeling, a sense of accomplishment. It's all about the power of action, the power of doing. Once you have a sense of accomplishment, I can do this, I can do another 2, and then another 2, and then another 10, another 20, right? So the five second rule is so powerful, but it needs a commitment and it needs a belief in the power of action. When you believe in the power of doing something when you're not ready or you haven't overthought it, that's what leads to its success. I just want to share with you an idea that I just came across lately about the power of action. You know, we just read in last week's Torah portion, we read about God giving the Torah on Mount Sinai, right? And that was the most dramatic event of Jewish history. It was the time that God chose us as a nation. Our whole definition, our whole identity comes from the Sinai story. And when God communicated the 10 commandments, this first one was the belief in God, right? So it said, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I am Hashem, your God, that I took you out of Egypt. And all the commentaries ask an interesting question. Taking us out of Egypt was an amazing thing, an amazing miracle. But of course, the authority of God doesn't come from the redemption from Egypt. the authority of God is that he's the creator of the world, right? It should have made much more sense for him to say, I'm introducing myself, hi, I am God, your God, who created you and created the world, right? That would have made more sense. Like, you need to listen to me because actually I created you. That would have made more sense, one would imagine. But I saw in a very beautiful commentary that one of the many reasons given for this, but one of the reasons is like this. Just before the giving of the Torah, it says that Moshe Rabbeinu's father-in-law, who was not Jewish, came to the desert. His name was Yitro, and he converted. He was an amazing person, and he joined the Jewish nation. Why? Because it says, Vayishma Yitro. Yitro heard, and he heard everything that God had done, that he had taken the Jews away from Pharaoh and away from Egypt. But it uses a very interesting expression. It says that Yitro heard that God had saved the Jewish people from the hands of Pharaoh and the hands of Mitzrayim. Why do you have to add in the hands? What does it mean, the hands? The hands of Pharaoh and the hands of Egypt. So he quotes a very fascinating, famous piece of the Talmud that says, you know, that when the Jews were slaves in Egypt, the Egyptians sought to, not just to have them work hard, but to actually oppress them and to dehumanize them and so on. So one of the parts of slavery was that they had to build these two cities, it says in the Chumash. They were called Pitom and Ramses, right? But what they had them do, which is not so known, it's a Midrashic interpretation of the Chumash, they had them work and build in quicksand so that everything they did would amount to nothing, which is obviously very, very oppressive and very dehumanizing, right? What does that mean, spiritually speaking? What they were trying to do, they were trying to destroy not just the body of the Jewish people, they were trying to destroy the soul of the Jewish people. Now, the soul of the Jewish people depends, as we just said, tremendously on action. Doing. We do. We make the world a better place. We don't philosophize only. We don't feel. We don't pray only. We don't meditate only. We do. That's the uniqueness of being Jewish. Doing. Action. Doing an act of kindness, act of a mitzvah, act of helping someone. Just getting stuff done, right? The Egyptians were trying to impact and influence and persuade the Jewish nation that action doesn't count. Action means nothing. You do today, it's gone tomorrow, it's all nothing. And they did that by having them do stuff that wouldn't have any meaning, that would disappear. And when God took the Jewish people out of Egypt, the number one goal of taking them out of Egypt was to teach them that in this world, action matters. It's the world of action. Not so much, you know, Kabbalistically, we have many eternal, supernal worlds, worlds of angels. They are not worlds of action. They're worlds of spiritual experience. They're worlds of transcendence. They're worlds of, I don't know what. I was never this. I can't tell you. But it's not the world of action. This is the world of action. The mundane, the physical world. This is the world that you accomplish, that the number one accomplishment in this world is doing something good, doing something positive, the power of action. Not, yes, we have to pray. Pray is important. We have to meditate, all important. We have to be spiritualized because that makes us a better person. But the goal of Judaism is not spirituality. I know that sounds funny coming from a rabbi, but it's not. The goal of Judaism is not spirituality. The goal of Judaism is doing. Helping someone else, doing a mitzvah, putting a mezuzah on a door, giving charity, doing stuff that's meaningful and purposeful, right? And that's why, that's what Yitro heard. Yitro heard that God had taken the Jewish people out of the hand of Mitzrayim and the hand of Pharaoh. He'd taken them out of the false perspective about hands. Hands are a symbol of action. He moved them away from Egypt. That's why when God revealed himself on Mount Sinai and he wanted to give us the Torah, he said, I am Hashem, your God, who took you out of Egypt. That's it. That's all you need to know. I want to schlep you out of this erroneous perception that action doesn't matter. And you should know from today onwards that action matters. Every small action matters. And as we talked about many times, every small action is eternal. Every time we do something that's positive, it's eternal, even if tomorrow we fail. If I do something positive, that action is in eternity. And it's powerful, and it has powerful ripple effects, and it's an amazing strength. And that's believing in the power of action. So I share that with you because That's really a little bit the same philosophy of the 5-second rule, right? You're in a rut. You don't feel it. You don't have it. You're not there yet. You're not interested. You know in the back of your mind what is right, but you don't know. You just can't get yourself to do it because you just don't feel it. And therefore, that becomes an impediment to you doing. And the 5-second rule is just get it done. Power of action, not only in spiritual stuff, but in every stuff. And every part of functionality of life, the power of action is amazing. And if you need the 5-second rule, then do the 5-second rule. If you want to do something, just do it right away. Don't wait to think it's right, not right. Overthink it. We get it done, and it's a positive thing, and it brings greater strength. The second part, which is the book we're going to be talking about mainly in the next few weeks, which is the Let Them Theory, actually has another very important philosophy behind it. You see, I said before, I think we've done this before, but I'll just explain it again because it's important. We talked before that it's very hard to change emotions, right? But action is powerful. But there's something else that's very powerful. And that is like this, the way the human experience works is that we function on three levels. Consciously, I'm talking about, right? I'm not talking about the subconscious power that we have, which is also important, but consciously, we function on three levels. Cognition, which we call seichel, emotion, and action. Action meaning speech, action, and so on, right? That's how it works. The one that's almost impossible to fundamentally change is emotion, right? What we can change is the other two layers, which is fascinating. We can change what we do, meaning we have the choice. We might be lazy, we might be stuck in bed, but if we catapult ourselves out and we count 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 and we just do it, we have the choice. Maybe I don't like what I've just done, or I didn't want to do it, and I was forced to do it, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, but I can do it, I can choose to do, right? And the other thing we can change is our way of thinking. Those are the only two things we can change. In fact, very anciently, the Rambam says this. Maimonides talks about one of the mitzvot in the Torah is to love God. And he says, how can you command someone to love God? He either loves him or he doesn't, right? Can I tell you, you must love that person? No, I don't love him, right? You can do something for someone who you don't like. You can choose to do that. I can have someone that's extremely annoying and I dislike completely and I can still go out of my way and do something for them. But that's my choice. It's a choice of action. You can't command me to love them. I don't love them. He annoys me. He gets on my nerves. Right? So how can God say you must love God? And we say this every day in the Shema. Ve'ahavtat Hashem Elokecha. Right? You shall love Hashem your God. How can you love him? And the Rambam says very interestingly in Hasidic philosophy, it elaborates this tremendously. But very anciently, the Rambam already says this, and the Rambam says that the commandment is not to love God. The commandment is to study and to reflect and contemplate the greatness of God, which will then lead you to love Him. And he says, the more you study His greatness, the more you study that He's the source of all blessing, the more you come to understand His greatness and His connection to us, then you will come to love Him. You can't switch on an emotion. You can't switch on a love. Right? So therefore, the process of change is only changing. Really, what we need to change is our emotions, because the emotions is us, right? That's why it's so hard to change. The one layer of those three layers that is really who we are is our emotions. Because the emotions, the feelings that we have is our personality, right? If someone's a grumpy person, not because he has a grumpy brain, he's got a grumpy heart, right? That's what it is. He can hold himself back, but the personality is right? The Talmud says you can tell you can tell a person's, it's like a play on words. The Talmud says you can tell a person's personality by three things. The koso with his cup, which means if he gets intoxicated, the kiso with his finance, or because so when he gets angry. Why? Because those are the three times a person won't control their emotions. So a person is drunk,
They don't say, you know, I better, maybe shouldn't say this, right? There's no filter. When a person's, most people, when they get very, very involved with temptation of finance, it becomes a big problem, and sometimes they lose control. And a person gets angry. Angry is losing control. So you see the real personality of the person coming out, right? Because very hard, so the emotions is our personality, and that's the hardest thing to change. What we can change is the two things on either side. We can change the action, and we can change the way we think. In a way, these two books are a bit like that, right? The 5-second rule is about changing action. Just do it. And then the let them theory is about changing the way we think. Reframing. Reprocessing how we look at things. Understanding ourselves better. And that's why it works. Because we need, this is the process, this journey of change. The journey of change means we need to change two things. What we do simultaneously, we need to do them both. Can't wait till we change our thinking, but we can just do. And we can also work on changing the way we think, changing in our perspectives. Because those are the two things we can change. Because why? Because action is something that's not me, I'm just something I'm doing. And by definition, cognition is also not me, it's something that I take from the outside and process. So that's why we know that this is the power of the brain. It's also the downfall of the brain. But the power of the brain is that if we want to, if we're committed to, we can invite in new ideas that don't fit with the way we feel. Because normally what happens instinctively, the impulse of a person is that we think the way we feel. In other words, we post-rationalize, right? Most people don't get unkind or cruel or angry with other people because they worked it out that way. It's because they have an instinctive emotional reaction and then have to rationalize it, right? Very, very rarely is there a really good reason to hate someone else. That's the truth. I mean, yes, there's hate, evil and all that. But sometimes when someone gets on our nerves, we have conflict, or I'm not in the mood of doing something, or I'm lazy, that's all emotional reactions. Then, of course, we come up with 100 reasons and 100, if you're smart, you come up with the very clever reasons of why I shouldn't be doing this, why I should be doing it, right? Therefore, in other words, in such cases, the cognition follows the emotion. But really, what we have to do is turn that around, like Torah tells us to do, in the book of Tanya talks about this a lot. We've talked about it amazingly, that the human being has the power, that the brain can rule the heart. And that's what we have to work on. Saying, yeah, I know what I'm feeling, and I know what I'm feeling in response to that feeling, and that's why I'm rationalizing it, but I have to stop, pause, and rethink myself, and relearn, and retell a different story. And that's really the basis, the commitment, because we're going to talk about, over the next few weeks, the let them theory. Let them theory is only going to work if you're prepared to do that. If you're prepared to actually open up, let in a different way of thinking. That takes a certain humility, a certain lessening of ego, which, you know, because ego is always in the blockage to not letting in other ways of thinking. But it is a commitment. And when you have that commitment, then you got to start, okay, now how do I reframe? How do I reinterpret my story? How do I reinterpret what I'm thinking? And that's what we're going to talk about. But you first have to be committed to that. And just connected to that, I want to share with you an interesting idea that I just came across. I came across a modality in therapy, which actually was the sort of the beginning of CBT, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy, but it's called something different. And it was made by I've forgotten his name, because it was a talk by his wife. So there's a leading therapist today. Her name is Debbie Ellis. She was actually born in Melbourne and grew up in Melbourne. Give me one second, let me find her husband's name. Mr. Ellis, yeah, probably. But anyway, it's a modality that I've forgotten his name now. She married him, he was a lot older than her. In his private life, he was an interesting guy if you Google him. But anyway, his theory is good. It's called REBT, Rational Emotive Behavior Therapy, right? Oh, Albert Ellis, that was his name, Albert Ellis. Right. His theory was novel at the time. He was actually a mentor to Aaron Beck, who was the father of CBT. And then he died 17 years ago, but she now is a big lecturer in Columbia University, and she lectures on all this. And I came across it, someone alerted me to it. And I watched a beautiful lecture of her. I've now ordered a book. Maybe we'll do a course on it one day. But It's a whole theory got to do with how we tell the story to ourselves. And here are the basics of the story, and it's very in line with Jewish thinking, right? It's a little bit, it's connected to CBT, it's connected to Viktor Frankl, it's connected to Edith Eger, and all these people who sort of all belong to one way of thinking. She does say, and this is the unfortunate thing, that after her husband died, like some 20 years ago, people are moving away. I don't think it's got to do with the death of her husband, I think it's got to do with how society is progressing, but they're moving away from that whole way of thinking, which is very, very, very sad. Maybe Mel Robbins will have some impact of walking it back, because she's now come back a little bit to that way of thinking. Because essentially it boils down to taking responsibility and stop blaming the whole world and just take responsibility for the way you think, right? And that's her theory. So she gives this amazing TED talk, and I want to just share a little bit with you. And the core message of her talk, I can post a link if you want, is that it's not what happens, it's what we tell ourselves. Remember, it's not what happens, it's what we tell ourselves. And she says, I believe that one of the greatest tragedies of humankind is that very few of us realize or are taught, learn, know, or believe that it's not the rotten circumstances, it's not what happens to us that creates our emotional experience and our reactions or our responses. It's what we tell ourselves what's going on that creates our emotions, right? Now she says, and this is the idea of rational emotional behavior therapy. In other words, it's about developing rational thinking and telling yourself a different story, right? Now, she gives an example. She says she was thinking about this during COVID, right? So she says that I remember in the early stages of COVID, many reporters on TV in newspapers were saying that because of COVID, the number of people suffering from anxiety and depression has grown, right? Now, we all know that anxiety and depression did rise during COVID. That's true. So she says something which is a bit bold to say. She says, well, I'm not disputing that the number grew, but I and REBT would assert it wasn't COVID. Because if it was COVID, then every single human biologically would have been experiencing depression or anxiety. Right? It's interesting. It's an interesting way of thinking. It's not COVID that made it, because they would have done it to everyone. Now, there's nothing about COVID that creates anxiety or depression, even though it certainly did happen. But it reminds us that it's what we were telling ourselves about the COVID. In other words, it's not the circumstance, it's what we tell ourselves about the circumstance, right? So she says, the first element is, it's not the event, it's not what happens, it creates our emotions, what we tell ourselves about it. The next thing is, she says, is that when we think about in irrational ways about bad things, we create what REBT calls unhealthy negative emotions. Now, this is a very interesting thing. So she doesn't talk about bad emotions, although in Judaism there is such a thing as bad emotions, but that's a different discussion. But she talks about negative emotions, like things like anxiety, like hopelessness, like rage, like guilt, like shame, all these things, right? These are born out of negative thinking. Because what she goes on to explain is that these emotions themselves are not necessarily bad. And we've talked about this a lot. They all have their place. It all depends how you think about the story, right? So for example, what she suggests is that we don't get rid of the negative emotions, but they become positive negative emotions. What does that mean? So for example, she says, when we think in rational ways, then those very emotions become positive. So for example, concern instead of anxiety. So we've talked about this before. Anxiety as its core, we once did a whole series on this, is a very good thing. People couldn't exist without anxiety. Especially if you're Jewish, but right? But you couldn't exist without anxiety. Why? Because then you never get anything done. You would never have a sense of urgency. No one would ever pass an exam. No one would ever finish an assignment on time or finish a job on time. Because I'm fine. Like, the world is great, right? So of course, if you have it's a week to go. I better start planning, right? I better put things in place. That's not bad. That's a healthy thing. It's the paralysis of anxiety that's a bad thing.
Now, what's the difference? They're both anxiety, actually, if you think about it. Like, oh, yeah, I better get this done. I've got 2 weeks to go. Let me put it together in plan. Let me spring into action and let me get it done and have a plan. Versus, I feel so uptight and anxious that I'm giving up. I'm paralyzed. They're both anxiety. The difference is the story we tell us, ourselves, and how we think about it. How we think about ourselves, right? Concern is motivating. Anxiety is paralyzing. Hopelessness, despondency, depression is negative. Healthy grief is positive. Understanding the loss of something, feeling the pain is really important. Something we spoke about last week, right? Feeling pain is not a bad thing, and feeling pain even for a long time is not a bad thing. And sometimes it's insensitive not to feel the pain. We talked about this in the context of Bondi, right? We should never move on, so to speak, but we move forward because we shouldn't forget, we should remember, but it should not paralyze, it should motivate. And that's going to depend on the thinking that we have. It's going to depend on the perception we have. Right? Instead of rage, there's something which we can call healthy anger. Now, we always talk about anger as being a really bad thing. What we really mean is rage. Rage is loss of control, irrational responses. But feeling upset about something is not a bad thing necessarily. Because sometimes it can motivate you to activate, to do, to respond. I'm angry about the situation, so let me do something about it, right? All these emotions, we call negative emotions, but they can become healthy negative emotions, right? And the way we do this is the following, she explains. And this, I'm just bringing this, that's very, very connected. It's a beautiful model. And it's such an important message, and it's very connected with being able to get into the let them theory. She says, the first thing is, we've got to get rid of certain things that we keep doing. One of those things is, should have. She says, you've got to stop should having, right? Should have done that, should have been this, should have been like that. No, we shouldn't, right? Especially from a Jewish perspective, right? Nothing should have happened. It's nonsense. Everything happens for a reason. It can be very painful, it can be very questionable. She doesn't talk about it. I mean, she's Jewish, but she doesn't talk about it in context of religion and belief. But if you talk about it from a Jewish perspective, that much more. The whole thing, oh, it should have been like this. It never should have happened. There's no such thing. In Judaism particularly, there's no such thing. Everything that happened should have happened. What the difference is, how are you going to respond to it? What are you going to do with it? So should have means it's not me. It's all about one thing, really. It's about responsibility. You remember that YouTube I shared with you from Viktor Frankl about responsibility? It's all about responsibility. We have to take responsibility for our own story and create the story we tell ourselves. What is going to happen is not going to change us. The circumstance doesn't bring the emotion. And by the way, the circumstance should have happened. Why? Because God made it happen. That's why. From a Jewish perspective, it's very simple. It's not even a big philosophy if you go with the Jewish principles. Everything that happened should have happened. Why God did? We don't know, but it should have happened. Now the question is, what are we going to do with it? So that's the first thing we should have. And the second thing is must. We've got to stop musting all the time, right? I must be liked by everyone. I must be successful. I must be able to do this. I must be able to do that. We all do that, right? Life should be fair and just, right? It's a nice thing. Of course it should be fair and just. But it's not always. And I must do this. Well, maybe it's not going to happen. Because maybe that's not your destiny. Maybe it's not your story. Maybe it's not your purpose. Maybe it's not your meaning. And again, from a Jewish perspective, you know, again, going back to last week's parasha, where one of the Ten Commandments is, and it's funny that it's one of the Ten Commandments because the Ten Commandments are supposed to be fundamental things, right? And one of them is, don't be jealous of someone else. Don't covet, is the English translation. I don't actually work out exactly what the word covet means, but that's what it says. Don't covet something belongs to someone else. Okay, that's a bad thing to covet. Jealousy is unhealthy, but why is it so fundamental? And the commentaries explain, because of course it's fundamental. Because it's fundamental to the belief in God. Why do I want something that someone else has? Because I think I should have it. Well, obviously, I'm not supposed to have it because God didn't give it to me. For now, maybe He'll give it to me a different time. But for now, I don't have it. So therefore, I wasn't meant to have it. I'm meant to live my life of meaning without that thing. It's really fundamental to the belief in Hashgacha Pratit. If we really believed in Hashgacha Pratit, we'd never be jealous. I mean, that's on a
ultimate level, right? But you would never be jealous because I don't have it because I'm not meant to have it today. Tomorrow, I don't know what's going to be tomorrow. That's God's plan. But so I've got to live my life and respond by telling myself the right story and responding. So when we get rid of shoulds and must and all those kind of words, which are all about not taking responsibility and all results in blaming a circumstance or a person for what I'm going through, then we cannot move forward. So the first step to being ready to change our thinking, which is the basis of the power of action, is the 5 minute rule, the 5 second rule. The power of let them is changing our thinking. Those are the two things you have to change: action and thinking. The first commitment, the first foundation of changing our thinking is this theory that the what you feel is made by what you think, not made by someone else, it's not made by something else, and it's not made by a circumstance. What you feel is made by the way you think. So you want to be happier, you want to be freer, you want to be more productive and find more meaning, you've got to change the way you think. And that's the foundation to the let them theory, which we're going to explore over the next few weeks. Have a wonderful week. Thank you.